This podcast is brought to you by A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. By the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and serve. And by Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. Cecily Alexander is a dietitian, a teacher, and a writer from London, Ontario. Her recently published memoir, Immigration, Race, and Survival, From Trinidad to Canada, Living in Parallel Worlds, will help you to understand racism as you journey with her through many experiences. Cecily has had a career as a dietitian for over 40 years. She has a master's in business administration specializing in organizational behavior, in addition to her nutrition degree from the University of Guelph. She has taught at both the university and college levels and is a faithful Anglican currently attending St. Aidan's Church in London, Ontario.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever and whenever you may be listening. We want to welcome you back to another and brand new edition of the Vicar's Crossing podcast. The Vicar's Crossing is a virtual space where faith intersects with the public square. And we are your vicars. I am Vicar One, Rob Henderson, and I serve as director at Holy Trinity St. Stephen's Anglican Church in London.
And I am Vicar Two, Thing Two, they sometimes call me, Kevin George. I'm at... St. Aidan's Anglican Church in the northwest part of the city. And I don't know how late it is. I don't know how late you can keep saying or that you're allowed to say, but I want to say Happy New Year because we haven't had one of these since back in December. So
that's right. Yeah.
So I feel like I want to say Happy New Year. People have been wondering if we dropped off the face of the planet, but we have not.
No, we have not. Our first foray into 2023 today. Yep. So in our eighth season, Kevin, season eight, episode number one. So we're
number one.
Down
yeah, we're getting ready, again. Baby.
Good. Well, I'm glad we could connect once again and glad we can connect with this first episode and a special guest that we'll be welcoming in just a moment. Today, we're excited to welcome to the podcast Cecily Alexander. And Cecily is a Londoner, a writer, a teacher, a dietitian, and an author of a book that we'll be exploring with her today. It is called Immigration, Race, and Survival, From Trinidad to Canada, Living in Parallel Worlds. Mm-hmm. And a book that's a real eye-opener for those who, you know, and we've heard this, may not think that they're racist. Yeah. And that maybe Canada is a little different from the United States. We certainly have heard that. Yeah. And that does maybe not have racism, but this is a real eye-opener. And Cecily's story is about that, and we'll chat with her coming up about that in a minute.
Quite looking forward to that. It is quite a memoir. Before we do that, we'd like to, obviously, as we do at the beginning of each of our episodes, acknowledge that the land upon which we record this podcast are the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, Lenape, and Attawandaran peoples, and are connected with the London Township and Somber Treaties of 1796 and the Dish with One Spoon Covenant Wampum. These lands continue to be home to diverse Indigenous peoples whom we recognize as contemporary stewards of the land and vital contributors of our society, and people with whom we wish to work together to walk towards healing and reconciliation.
And we also want to take a moment to thank our sponsors here at the Vicar's Crossing podcast. First to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family owned and operated. Our thanks to Dave Mullen for his continued support and the support of all the staff at A. Miller George today.
Yes, and great guy over there, that Dave Mullen, I'll tell you. I also want to say thank you to the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, from Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and to serve, and sending out our gratitude to our Bishop Todd Townsend and all of the dioceses who support this endeavor.
Mm-hmm. And to our good friends at Molly Maid, make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. And our thanks, as always, to Tricia Listar and the whole crew at Molly Maid for their generous support over the years on the podcast. We really do appreciate that.
They certainly do know how to clean up over there.
They do. They do. Yeah. And if anyone needs cleaning, it's these two priests.
That's right. There's definitely sure. Anytime we come around, all you hear is clean up an aisle two. Clean up an aisle two. These two have made a mess again.
Well, I hope we don't make a mess today in this podcast, because we are looking forward to talking to Cecily about her book and her memoir. And she's going to be joining us here in just a few moments.
Yes, she's about ready to come in, and you're going to love Cecily. I've gotten to know her a little bit. She's been attending St. Aidan's, and she's got a great story to tell. So let's welcome her in, and she can bring her beautiful memoir to all of you.
And so happy to have Cecily Alexander on our podcast today in the Vicar's Crossing, all the way from London. Ontario,
this London?
Right?
This London,
from
right?
This London, yeah. Yeah, usually we have to fly our guests in thousands of miles, but Cecily is really close by, so we're so glad to have you here. How are you today, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you with us. You are just a gift. We've been reading your memoir and taken by the incredible resilience and your strength. There's a lot in this book that we want to get to right away. I want to begin by having you perhaps outline for our readers, as you did, our listeners, as you did for the readers in the book, what it was like for you coming to Canada in the 1970s. You grew up in a racialized society in post-colonial Trinidad, but you hadn't, as you describe it, directly experienced racism before you came to this country, certainly not in the overt ways that you describe it once you got here. You write in the introduction of the memoir about the differences between asserted identity, your asserted identity, and the assigned identity that Canadians placed upon you when you got here. You moved to Edmonton, your brother had come ahead of you, and had encouraged you to move up here for university. Can you tell us more about those distinctions and your experience of coming to Canada with your asserted identity and the assigned identity people wanted to give you?
Sure, Kevin. I was 19 years old, so naive. I just finished high school. I grew up in a very middle-class background. I did all the usual things like ballet and spent my weekends at the beach. It was idyllic in a lot of ways when you think about it. Mm-hmm. Most of my friends were heading off to the University of the West Indies, but my brother thought I should come up to Canada, so I did. So I arrived in Canada and in October of 1969, and my brother thought, okay, you can work for the year and save some money towards your university. That's a good thing. So that's what I did. I had my A-levels. Believe it or not, those were departmental. It's posted to England.
Oh, wow.
Then posted back to Trinidad. Yeah. So I had high marks and had a bookkeeping certificate that I took over the summer in preparation for working. And I walked the streets and just couldn't understand. I thought a clerical job I would have gotten immediately in Trinidad with my background, but nobody would hire me. So I lowered my levels a bit. I thought, okay, here's a Kodak counter. I just needed someone to work a cash register. Yeah. So I applied for the job. And the owner, I still remember his name, Mr. Ingalls. He came and he held my hand and he said, Cecily, you're such a lovely person. I would love to hire you. But I'd lose my customers and my business.
Wow.
Exactly what he said. I left. Went to a park bench and just cried. I just didn't understand. I thought of going back home, but I saw that as a bit of a defeat. And I thought I'd take on the challenge. And as I said, at that early stage, it put Canada into perspective of what this life would have been. So that was it.
Yeah, so say a little bit more about, because I read that and I just thought, 19 years old, like you're in a new country, and this man tells you this. I mean, God
winter.
Bless him. In Edmonton, Alberta, from Trinidad. God bless this man for his honesty to tell you what was going on. But I was really taken by your reflection about assumed identity and asserted identity. Can you say a bit about that? Because you write about what people expect of someone coming from Trinidad.
Right. And I really realized very early that my assumed identity, being middle class, from a very comfortable family with all of the trimmings that came with that, mm-hmm. was not what people thought about people from the Caribbean. They saw us as poor, as immigrants coming, well, of course, coming here for a better life, but very, very different. And with that came all the stereotypes of people that are Black, you know?
Yes.
Concern about whether we are honest or dishonest or just who we were as
people. Yeah, and that tends to color everything, right? So and the experiences that you describe in the book, whether it be your early days or then later on at work, through your time here in this part of the country as well, that there's these stereotypes continue to come up. Yeah, you write about growing up in Trinidad, where there was a fairly well-defined class-related structure, where there was a defined difference. You describe everyone as sort of knowing their place. You knew to respect anyone who was in a position higher than you. You just quote a little piece of the book here. You write, "I understood at an early age that I had internalized the unfairness and injustice of racialized behavior, and my middle-class upbringing had not required me to be deferential to whites. At this point, I realized that most of the Canadians I had met so far were ignorant about the life in the Caribbean, and Trinidad in particular. If they thought about us at all, they saw us as poor immigrants, and we were not in their class. I wanted to be accepted in Canada for who I was, and not as a stereotype, as you had said. I would have to change that attitude one person at a time," which I've thought, holy moly, that's got to be a monumental task when you're 19 years old. I'm going to change all these Canadians person at a time. You highlight in the book that your brother had an interesting observation, that he felt that for Blacks in America, they had been conditioned for generations to be deferential to whites. And I think that's true to a degree here in Canada as well, by the way. But you point out that you didn't project that attitude of subservience, right? So a part of the challenge for you, or for people, I guess, encountering you, was that you weren't going to defer. Can you say more about trying to tear down those stereotypes and addressing that ignorance, as you say, one person at a time?
It's really interesting, you know, because I think the reason that I've survived so well is I always saw prejudice as something limiting in the other person's personality, something they didn't know. I never really took it to heart. It didn't break me down to think, oh my God, this person thinks I'm this, so that means I am.
Right.
And I gave quite a few examples in my book, like one was my brother Mookin at Amoco as engineers were recruited in the oil fields in Edmonton. And his boss at the time, giving him feedback, was thanking him for being so direct and outright and giving him feedback about the position. He brought that to my attention. And I started to think of other colleagues and friends that I've had that reacted the same way. I'd given my book an example of some friends that were going to university in the Maritimes in Nova Scotia, actually. Mm-hmm. And they went into a restaurant and just weren't being served. Mm-hmm. And Donald got up and demanded, "What is going on? I've been here for whatever." And da 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 da. I guess the people were just so shocked that someone Black would come. And I think if you were Nova Scotian Black, you would have just quickly exited, although you had the money to pay, and not bothered with addressing it. But interestingly, I've continued to research since my I just have it here. Since my memoir has been written, I'm totally engrossed in the literature and what has been going on. Mm-hmm. And I came across this reference from Winston James, who was examining Caribbean immigrants in the turn of the century. So this is in the early 1900s. And he said it was really significant. People, you recognize some of these names: Marcus Garvey, Sybil Briggs, Claudia Jones, C.L.R. James, George Padmore, Jesus Cole, and a lot of others. And they, when they came from the Caribbean to America in the turn of the century, they were shocked at the way they were perceived by whites, and put down, and the lynchings and things that they didn't know about in the Caribbean. We actually didn't know that this existed. And they were very politicized. These were the first, and then the way they reacted to it was by the NAACP and organizations that they joined, even the Communist Party. But they really fought. We had significant people that fought against these stereotypes at a very early stage in our migration. So we are different. We are different in terms of how we approach any racism that we run into. Yeah. You see, in the Caribbean, you have to realize that, and I mentioned this in my memoir, everybody that my lawyers, my doctors, my politicians, they're all people of color, East Indian or Black. So you didn't have that stereotype in terms of us being second-class citizens or unintelligent or any of those things, right?
I'd like to talk about with you something that this is something I've just learned about, and certainly you've helped me with this, the Montreal computer riots at St. George Williams University. Now, this is something that took place in January of 1969. I'm sure it's a story that not many Canadians are really familiar with. I certainly wasn't. And the backstory is that there was a complaint about a computer professor who was consistently lowering the grades of West Indian Black students. And this all kind of escalated to an uprising or a riot, I guess, depending on how you look at it. But I really think it's a story that speaks certainly to the resilience of West Indians who, as you say, expected to be treated equally and were prepared to stand up for that equal treatment. I wonder, Cecily, if you can talk a little bit more about that story and what your take on that.
Knowing that really also gave me the knowledge to know what I may experience in terms of North America and in Canada in particular. So, I mean, it was just awful after the riots. And they had things like let the niggers burn. They were beaten. There were 1,044 charges of only 9 were upheld. So that tells bias of what happened at that time. And they were portrayed as criminals and thugs. But interestingly, let me tell you, 3 of the people that I have in my memoir that were part of this riot, Rosie Douglas, who became the Prime Minister of Dominica, and Cools, the first Black member of Canada's Senate, and Jock Jagan, he was the son of the Guyanese Prime Minister. So that's what I'm saying, you know, we came up here thinking we are equal and treated as second-class citizens and stereotypically the stereotypes that you have of Blacks in Canada. And I've actually said more than once that I think the stereotypes, I came to realize that your knowledge, your being Canada, knowledge of Blacks is very, very narrow. And it's what you know from the States in terms of colonialism there and Jim Crow laws and segregation. And that's it. You know, it's been an evolution to think of Blacks differently.
Right. Yeah, and Kevin and I have talked about this a lot, about different ways in which we were educated growing up. And this kind of stuff was not, in curriculums, and certainly stories about the riots of Sir George Williams. I'm not saying that it was never talked about, but I don't remember anything like that. And I had to do some research on it just this morning when I was preparing to talk to you, just to get an understanding. But it's not something that we ever heard of or saw of. So you came up against racism a lot in your work environment too. And you talk about that and you write about that in the book. And you write about microaggressions and micro invalidation in the book. And the number of incidents of these that you faced is really remarkable. And also remarkable is how you championed on despite all of that. And it really, you say it only really broke you when your husband was dying, right? Yeah. And I wonder if you could just take a moment to help our listeners and us too here today understand microaggression, micro-invalidation. What is that? Maybe give a couple of examples, because you do mention a couple in your memoir.
Right. Well, the other thing that I've said is that I knew what was happening to me was wrong. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the words. And many people think of racism as overt, you know, calling somebody by different names. Mm-hmm. But that's not micro invalidations and microaggressions, I think, became more common in the later 80s with political correctness, really, mm-hmm. to be honest. Mm-hmm. And but the racism was still there. But there were laws against someone
yes.
Calling you names and treating you very overtly. So microaggressions, these are sort of snubs, slights, and insults that are given to you. But micro invalidation is the one that is most significant to me. I'm going to step back and say I only knew this word in 1917, just a few years ago, where I was skiing in Utah, and a guide said to me when I was explaining to him, Cecily, those are microaggressions. And I came back and researched it, and I, like a window opened up inside of me. I thought, oh my gosh, this fits in what I was experiencing so precisely. So let me talk to you about micro invalidation. Invalidation is really trying to make that person invisible. And how they do it. And I had the actual definition here. But it really, in terms of what's done, they try to invalidate anything that you stand for or who you are. So I'll tell you about my experience with this at actually right here in University Hospital in London. If people buy my memoir, I've disguised the name, but now I'm being a bit more upfront about it.
I got to say, Cecily, you threw me for a loop because I'm reading a book and I thought, where is this hospital? And what is this? And what is this Greensville? Where is this Greensville?
I know. So I think it's ultra care that I called University Hospital. Anyhow, yeah. So I'm there and excited. I came from Kitchener to there for a management position. And I had the most fantastic VP that let me just run with how I developed the department, change things. We did research. All different specialties were supposed to be fairly approachable to doctors and apply their knowledge and research in their different areas. So we grew like leaps and bounds. But anyhow, some of you who are from London would know that in 1994, we went through major restructuring and we decreased, it was called the downsizing in our middle management. So we went from something like 40 managers to 17.
Wow.
I thought I was lucky because my position was saved. All my other colleagues, the head of physio, OT, et cetera, lost their jobs, which in retrospect, if I had gone with them, I wouldn't have gone through But anyhow, I was saved. And because I was very entrepreneurial in the position before, which was encouraged, I was given a job. My job changed from manager to coordinator. Half of it was to be in charge of the dietitians, and the other half was to be under food services, doing program development and business development. So, some ideas basically to make money, but which was very exciting to me to do. But I got a boss that I called my nemesis.
Yeah.
You have to read my memoir to find
really. It's incredible.
A couple of instances that happened before with her. But when she came to the job, back to micro invalidation, what she did immediately, and she came into my office within the first week. So you have to know that micro invalidation isn't based on any past experience. It's based on, because I had no line relationship with her. So it's just based on her impressions of me as a Black person, right? So she said, I shoot from the hip and told me all these things that were wrong with me, which were very personal, my accent, and that I that wasn't always understandable. I was too friendly. I was too I was too friendly with my staff. You know, a lot of things, and I'm touchy-feely too. So, you know, just all of those things that were inappropriate for a manager or someone in my position that I had to change. But the thing that hurt me the most was she told me I wasn't a good team player. And nothing from my past would suggest that I wasn't a good team player.
Right.
And she called it team-mindedness. I even went to educational services and said, help me with this. And he said, okay, I'll go and see if I could get her to define what she meant. And she couldn't, because I thought, if I have a defined, like, I'll change what she wants me to change. But the biggest things that she did, which is micro invalidation, is she took me off all the committees I sat on. The one committee I sat on, she had a nurse on it report everything I said, and she critiqued that after. I chaired my dietitian's meetings, and she took me off of that, and she chaired them herself.
Wow.
Or delegated them to other dietitians to chair the committee themselves. I reported directly to the VP on my business development progress, and she took me off of that and reported to that. She literally silenced my voice all the way through. And to sum it up, at the end of that year, we had to amalgamate with University Hospital and Victoria Hospital, and that's when she fired me. And they say it's not firing. They said it was restructuring, downsizing, but I was fine. And quietly to me, she said, I got a good package and the whole thing. It wasn't some of those awful firings that you hear about. But the bottom line was, she said to me, I didn't trust you. Mm. That's such a big theme with people that don't understand Blacks and that we're dishonest and we can't be trusted. So that was what came out in terms of firing.
Can I just pick up on that for a second and ask you, because I think one of the most powerful examples of that mistrust is around when Wayne, your husband, got sick.
Yeah.
And you needed time. I mean, those to me are some of the more powerful examples.
Right. That's my second big experience. Because again, clinically, I was stellar. You know, I was on top of my game. I read a lot. And even although I realized I had all kinds of microaggressions at this hospital because it was conservative, implicit bias, you name it. I can go through tons of those examples. But those didn't really bother me because I was really good for 8 years, actually. Mm. I had a dietitian manager of which I was on top of my game. I became president of the college. I taught at Brusher University. Lots of good things that were happening to me at that time. And I was very satisfied with myself. Then I restructured again. I got another nurse manager who, oh my gosh, from day one, she tried to break me. Mm. And one of the things that she did was she just wouldn't communicate with me. She met with other dietitians, but just communicated with me by emails. And I have, I don't know how many, I don't have to jump right into my husband's
illness. Tell us about that.
So in spite of a lot of examples I have of her treatment of me and taking away my roles, which I can explain to you if we had time, what happened and when I was broken, because even for all of those, I stood strong.
Yeah.
I stood confident. But when I was broken was when my husband was diagnosed with terminal cancer with a year and a half to live. Mm-hmm. And within that time frame, she said, most guys don't die with prostate cancer.
Wow.
And she didn't believe me that he was dying. I said, but it's metastasized. We caught it too late. It's a year and a half. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, for the first year, it wasn't that bad for Wayne. And I had two sick days, one when he was rushed into hospital for emergency surgery and another one. And she took it upon herself because she couldn't discipline me because of my work ethic or my work. So what she did was she disciplined me under something called attendance management program. So attendance management is what you do for people who are truant with sick days. But I only had two. Each one of them, I was disciplined. Okay. I was losing weight. I was crying spontaneously. I was a mess.
Of course.
About after that first year when we got more serious. And a few nurses sort of pulled me into the nursing room station and said, Cecily, you have to go on short-term disability, like you're ill, you know, you're not surviving. So I went to the health nurse who said, absolutely. Then went to my boss who said I needed a psychiatric assessment.
Wow.
Proof that I needed to go off.
Yeah.
And everyone knows how difficult it is to get a doctor, fellow as a psychiatrist, to assess you on short term. So I still went in and tired, exhausted. I still went to work and tried to work until one day I couldn't. Mm. I was scared of, I wouldn't go through the incident, but I thought I was not thinking clearly. So that was the day I left. Whether I could have gone and leave or not, I left. Went straight to my doctor, who then assessed me. He wrote my short-term disability immediately. And he said, how could they give you such inaccurate information? I do this all the time.
Right.
So it was very much a route to get rid of me. But anyhow, my husband did die during my short-term disability. When it was finished, I went back to work. Within a week, my boss had me into her office and gave me my third disciplinary notice for being ill, off ill. Since then, for my memoir, I researched attendance management because I didn't know much about it at the time. And my illnesses or being off are called non-culpable.
Mm-hmm.
And should it be treated with counseling and not discipline?
Mm-hmm.
I retired before fourth incident because with attendance management, with four incidences, you can be fired.
Wow.
So that was ultimately the worst microaggressions that I experienced was under this second manager because it went on for 5 years.
Wow. I just can't imagine when you're going through something as tender as the loss of your spouse, you're going through that grief, you know it's coming. It's that, I think you describe it in the book as that horrible blessing, right? Or however it's described, like, you know, it's you know it's coming, so you've time to say all those things, but there's a great emotion to that. And for any boss, any supervisor in a work environment to lack any compassion and understanding, it's hard not to see it as microaggression and micro invalidation and, in fact, just overt racism. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, one of the things you write, you also speak about briefly in the book, and I know you've done some further research on this, is around, you know, the business of diversity training, because you think about that and you think, oh, the hospital should do some diversity training. You know, if they just did diversity training, then everything would be okay, right? Well, what you point out is, no, it won't be all right. Like the diversity training, all these institutions have done these things, but we still are having this conversation in Black History Month. We're talking to you, and we're not talking about decades ago. We're talking about in your work lifetime. So there's a piece missing you write about. Talk to us about that.
Again, after leaving University Hospital, I did my MBA, but in organizational theory and design. So I was very much interested in something like a diversity program. And actually, it was right here in London, Life in London, that I did an extensive questionnaire. They had a big diversity program. So I interviewed the guy who did it. He wrote a book. Like, I really explored diversity in a big way, thinking, oh, this is going to be the solution. But realized that diversity was missing a big clump. Because diversity is almost, for organizations, like a headcount, right? Yeah, we have so many Blacks. We have so many females. We have so many LGBTQ people, et cetera. You know, they can do a box and count it. But if it doesn't have inclusion, which is what a lot of programs are having now, and back then, it was in 1995, so it's a few decades ago, that I wrote my paper. And now I'm really encouraged by the inclusion part of it. And I wanted to actually tell it to you in terms of the specific definition of inclusion. Yeah. So it says that inclusion means your opinions are heard, they're valued, they're supported, respected, and people feel a sense of belongingness. And if you relate these to the two incidents I experienced, definitely not inclusion. Right. You feel safe to express your opinions, and you're given equal opportunity to raise ideas and be heard when something feels wrong. So that's inclusion. And one of the things that I was very, very encouraged by was the fact that I am on the mailing list. I'm looking for it. I'm on the mailing list of Stratford, the Stratford Festival. Mm-hmm. They, in their past newsletter, talks about inclusion, but it talks about something else. And if you bear with me, I will mention it. It actually talks about white supremacy. And I did a talk just a few days ago, and I talked about this. And I said, I know when you hear the word white supremacy, you're thinking of white hoods and white gown. And you conjure this up. But if you listen to the meaning, the belief that white people constitute a superior race and should dominate society, typically to the exclusion and detriment of other ethnic groups. Or more simply, the description is white people are better than other groups and should have power over them. So when that is implicitly what people just think, that's why a lot of what is happening happens. So that's it's those thoughts, you know, that we are better. You are not deserving. I think a big part of the problem. And so I'm really glad now that EDI programs are looking at that.
You've seen that movement over the last three decades, say, since you've written your paper.
And that's what really has encouraged me. The Stratford said that as a company, we have upheld white supremacy. And that's why I'm using it, because they have actually have it.
Good on them. We need more organizations to say that stuff.
In the past, it must be dismantled, they say. We are committed to evolving our understanding of equity, inclusion, and anti-racism, and to be celebrating and giving a platform to array of voices. And they admit that they haven't done that.
Good on Stratford. I mean, that's...
That was big. I thought that was big when I read it.
That's huge.
Yeah, definitely. I'll talk a little bit about Wayne, if we could. You met your husband, Wayne, in the early 1970s. And it's quite a love story. You met while you were both dating someone else.
It's quite salacious. You got to read the book.
Oh, yeah. That's right. There might be a movie coming out.
There's a movie, I'm telling you.
I like it. You dated for a number of years before you were married. I was taken by your description of how Wayne's circle of friends actually displayed some, you know, overt racist behaviors. And you describe an incident in your book about that. I'm wondering if you have it in front of you, would you be willing to read that short bit for us? And then I'll have a question that you can expand on the other side of that.
Okay. So this is actually occurred at a pub in Walkerton, that one, right? Mm.
Yes.
The Walkerton story.
Wayne's parents' farm. He was from Walkerton. We were having some drinks with Wayne and about six other friends. No other Black people were in the pub. Actually, for years, I was the only person of color in Walkerton and the surrounding towns when I went up to the farm with Wayne on the weekends. There were about eight of us, six guys and two girls, including myself. This very drunk guy stood up at the door and kept calling me a jigaboo. That was the first time I'd heard the word, but I understood that it was a racial slur. This went on for a while. No one at our table, the servers, the bar owners, or any other patrons in the pub said anything to this man or tried to remove him. I realize now that at some level, they agreed with Islam. Later, I asked Wayne why he hadn't done something. He said, the man was drunk. I didn't want to start a fight. I thought it was best to ignore him. And I also said, I know in Trinidad, a Trinidadian Black man would have beaten the guy's brains out. Yeah. It would have ended up in something aggressive if he was insulting his girlfriend.
Right. And then you go on to see, you ask the question to yourself, why would I stay with someone
why would
who
I stay
does
with
not defend,
my honor?
Defend my honor.
So and I send this on, it's complicated.
Yeah, it's a complicated answer. Can you maybe talk more about that complication? Yeah. Share a little, if you will, about, you know, how this relationship and relationship to your sons was complex as well.
Right, right. You see, what I loved about Wayne, because my brother eventually after his MBA went to Cornell to do his after his engineering degree, went to Cornell to do his MBA in the States and was encouraging me to come down to the States. And I really, the reason I wouldn't want to go to the States is I thought, no, in dating, not that I didn't want to date people like myself or people of color, but I always say, think of opportunity. University. Really white guys, right? And I was going to date someone just because they were black. But anyhow, back to Dayton. And Wayne was gorgeous, you know, tall, good looking. If you just from the physical, he was a lovely person. But anyhow, in terms of going to the States, I always said, I cannot think I could find a white guy in the States that didn't hear the N-word or hasn't been exposed to racism. And that was what was significant about Wayne. He grew up in Waukatan, in such a white society, no diversity at all. The only time he met people of color was when he went to university after he left home. So as an adult, he really wasn't prejudiced, you know? Right. He accepted me or anyone of color for who they were. He loved Trinidad. I didn't want someone to love me. Like, he did find me a bit exotic, but I didn't want him to love me for the stereotypes of black women or from that perspective. So in a funny sort of way, that's what I loved about Wayne. And back to him, he was 6'2", but the most docile person out. And I remember saying to him, back to my boys, I said, Wayne, he didn't understand how I felt in terms of racism or being teased, you know?
Right.
And I related that to the fact, I remember saying to him once, I said, Wayne, you're 6'2", eyes are blue, very docile personality. Like, there's nothing people can shout or say to you. You're a WASP. You're not Eastern European or Italian or Greek or some of the other white ethnic groups that you might have heard slurs thrown at. He didn't understand. And it was only a problem with his mixed kids in terms of how he dealt with them and how he treated them or how he saw them in terms of the law.
Yeah. And you write about that in the book as well, about, you know, a couple of incidences with your kids where, you know, Wayne just didn't quite get it the way that you get it.
Didn't get it. The thing that I always say, the one time that tried our relationship in terms of our marriage even was when he found a bag of grass, dope, marijuana. And what his thing to that to show my son a lesson was, he called up a cop and gave it back to him. And I said, he's a mixed kid, a black kid. They're going to put him in jail. Do you think they're just going to give him a little lecture if he's a little white blonde boy? No, you know, I couldn't believe it. And in a way, that was the worst setup he could have done with my children in terms of anyhow.
Yeah.
It's their story to tell. I said I didn't. I put a bit in about my feelings towards my kids, but I could have, at one point when I was writing my memoir, I put a lot more, but I thought no, I took it out.
Yeah.
I thought it's their story to tell at some point.
Well, I have to say to you that it comes through in the memoir just how much you love Wayne and how much Wayne loved you, and he sounded like a beautiful man, and. I've since heard, you know, as we've gotten to know you and read the book, people around town too, through the ski club and so on, that Wayne was well-loved in his community.
He was.
Yeah.
He was a gentle giant, you know.
Yeah.
Just who he was. You know, well, the ski club, they're named a runner.
Yes. Wayne's Way, yeah, yeah. Oh, you know, I want to ask you about something which is not written about explicitly in the book, but I know you must have experience of this. I mean, obviously, we here on the Vicar's Crossing, we like to talk about the intersection between faith and the public square. And as it relates to, you know, Black History Month and anti-racism and unpacking the stereotypes. I mean, as Rob said, we grew up, both of us cisgendered, hetero white dudes in Canada, unaware of the bathwater I was living in and how privileged I was just because of my skin color. I think there's no other place where that's more evident for me since I've become more aware than in the church. It's grossly evident in the church, in fact, and I didn't see it. It was a blind spot for me for many, many years until people helped me unlearn some of the things that I've learned and have been teaching me to listen more carefully and watch more closely for these things. I wonder, as a faithful Anglican, can you share with us your experience of racism in the church? I mean, we'd like to think of the church as a larger support. You talk about those supports you had in the book, your friends, your extended family, and so on, when you had those times. You did speak of a chaplain that you confided in at the time at the hospital. But I know, you know, being in congregations in southwestern Ontario, you were probably one of the few faces that were not pasty white like mine, and you must have come up against racism in the church. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. I know the audience to this podcast are going to be other Anglicans that I know. So I had a whole chapter on this in my book that I took out.
Okay. Yeah.
Then put it in. I'll share a couple things with you, but I'll just do it from my perspective. You know, when I moved to my house now, I went to the local church and went there for three different Sundays, and nobody ever said anything to me. So I realized quickly, no, I'm not going to be welcome here. I was the church I went to after that, I was extremely welcome. We had a pastor that Wayne came to church at Christmas time, Easter, Christmas, every time I dragged him in. And he said, he loved the minister because he remembered his name all the time. And very welcoming, very, very welcoming. And I'm going to relate to you an incident that I had. But you have to realize this is my whole church. This is one person, right? Mm-hmm. But it does illustrate a major stereotype. We have something called, we had a rummage sale that a lot of churches have, and I helped out. We all asked to help out, and I helped out in clothes because I love clothes. So that's why I helped out. And I would see all these things that I would buy for friends and family. They're $2 to $5. So that's the price. That we sold. And I would usually round it up, you know, here's 20 or here's 30 or whatever when I was paying for them. The fallen rummage sale, we had this young girl that could be my daughter, which is a little bit more insulting, say that she was put in charge of clothes that year and that I had to give her everything that I bought to count and pay her for it. I mean...
Like you couldn't be trusted.
Wow. Yeah.
Block, you know, it's money. Yeah. You can't be trusted. I was stealing before. Because what I do is take all these things in, into the room where I kept my stuff, choose all the stuff, and then wronged off something to the person that was taking cash. I was significantly hurt about it. I did talk to my mother about it. She probably talked to the person in charge. And I thought at that time, I actually even thought of leaving the church at that time. But I realized the bigger picture, and Michelle Obama says it all. When they go low, you go high.
Yes.
And I've always thought about, that's how I was brought up, you know, be the biggest person in the situation, be bigger than what it is. And I saw it as that. One incident, one person's thoughts, or maybe one or two, but the majority of people weren't that way. So I went back. I even actually ran the rummage sales for the church for years after that and made them all kinds of money because business is the thing, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Don't get any ideas.
Yeah, don't get any ideas, Kevin.
Careful. Yeah. Careful.
I just made a couple notes, okay?
Yeah. So before we let you go today, let's look ahead. Let's talk about the future a little bit. There's no doubt we all lament anti-immigrant rhetoric that we hear, and it exists and it's real. And that said, though, there are also a lot of voices, many of them young voices, calling all of us to a higher standard. And we hear that certainly as well. Can you talk to us about your hopes for how we can move from, you know, responses that can be, you know, described as white fragility, like, well, I'm not racist.
Oh, I'm not a racist.
I'm not. To having actual serious conversations about anti-racism, because that is a place we definitely need to move into.
Yeah. There's some places I'm optimistic and others I am less. But in terms of optimism, I ended my memoir very, what I say, naively, saying, let's like you to move from being not racist to anti-racist. Then I started to explore what anti-racism is. And it is, for the person, it's almost their own pilgrimage in terms of reading and familiarizing themselves with the terminology and the experiences and meanings of words and how they are being insensitive. And not many people are, I think, are there yet, or close to being there yet. So it's a fairly naive challenge that I gave. And when I think, what I do now is I talk about race all the time, you know. I mean, it just seems to come up. While I say that the majority of my friends, 90% of my friends are white, and my husband is white, my present partner is white, so I live in a white world. Mm-hmm. So it does come up now, and I try to educate and change. But when you think of the spectrum, and you think about halfway there, many people are still way over here. You know? And like one of my friends, you've heard it too, Cecily, what about White Lives Matter? And Blue Lives Matter? And not shooting them in the back, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Traffic infraction. You know, so it's I'm seeing my role as education in that respect. And for the ingrained racist attitudes of the older population, I think that's where the challenge is a lot harder. I'm very optimistic for the younger generation. One of my sons thinks that, why are you talking all about this? I haven't experienced whatever. And I'm thinking to him, you grew up with Southern vacations and skiing at the ski club and a fairly protected environment. But anyhow, all that said, I think that the younger generation is where I'm being very optimistic. In the same sense, where I'm not as optimistic is a lot of the hate and hate crimes that are coming out and the groups that
it's on the rise.
And more from the states here. But let's just hope that with all this extra awareness, the younger generation and education in the schools and places like Toronto, where half of your schoolmates or more than half are people of color, people of different races, different countries, that's going to be less and less. Yeah. And we'll be able to stand up against some of the hate crimes that are happening today.
Right. Yeah, and I share that too. I mean, I think that I worry that there seems to be a vein in politics right now. Particularly on our national scene, where they want to exploit these differences and inflame a sort of a white rage against, you know, they're taking away from us. But there is hope in our young people. I mean, when you listen to, and I think this way in the church too. I mean, like Rob and I have had a ton of people on here over the last few years, but as I think about the conversations that are happening in the diocese here, you know, we have the archdeacon we have for reconciliation, Rosalind Elm. Roz is an amazing Oneida person who's doing incredible work in the diocese. The Reverend Hannah Scorer, who is constantly helping us unpack some of our white privilege and what's going on in the church and the colonialism that we're still trying to deal with. Stephen Green, who I just heard Wednesday had preached up at the university, who's the priest up in in Luke, and Stephen gave an incredible sermon. And as a young black priest in the diocese, is bringing a new voice. And, you know, our archdeacon here in London, Sam Thomas, is becoming increasingly more frank about what he's been through in his 35 years or so here in Canada as an Indian man. So I think there is hope for where we're headed. And I think books like your own are a great part of that. I think that even just a few years ago, I'm not sure that I can speak for me. I didn't take Black History Month as a time to pick up books by Black authors. Through February now, that's almost all I've read. So, you know, I think that that's a part of the thing is who's in your bookshelf? What are you reading? You know, who do you surround? Where do you put your body next to? You know, that sort of geography of self. You know, but,
yes. Very, very optimistic. And part of what I think needs a little bit more education on is this whole thing about people are so scared about immigration and refugees. And I'm talking to the white population.
Yeah.
And I say Canada is still 73% white.
Yes.
This 4 or 5% black, we had so much of the minority. We're not taking over, believe me.
Exactly.
But there's that fear, you know, about our jobs are going to you. I read a job ad that says they want somebody, people of color or whatever in it, just to equalize some of what other than fairness that went on in the past and lack of hiring. Yeah. But the other thing is refugees are only about 5% of all our immigration.
That's right.
And I think we have to educate people on the fact that we need immigrants. 90% of our growth is from
absolutely.
And if we don't have it, or they don't come, or we don't, and they can't be white because people from England or France or the white countries are not coming anymore. That's not
right. That's not showing up. Definitely,
it is people of color, and that's partly why there's a little bit of the resentment or scare or fear of being taken over in some capacity. Yeah. But that's not it. We just want equality, not
superiority.
Exactly. Cecily, we really want to thank you for taking the time with us on the podcast, but mostly thank you for your work and your memoir, your willingness to share your story, to be vulnerable, and to tell that story. It's in the storytelling that we move more toward understanding and wholeness, and your story is going to resonate with people on all sides. And I really want to thank you for educating us today and for sharing all this with our listeners today. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good question.
And the book, again, we want to tell everybody once again to look for it, Immigration, Race, and Survival from Trinidad to Canada, Living in Parallel Worlds. The author is, there it is, holding it up right there for our YouTube watchers today. Cecily Alexander is the author and also our guest today on the Vicar's Crossing.
Thanks so much.
And again, thanks to Cecily for her time today and her wonderful memoir. And we certainly encourage everybody to take a look at that and find it where you buy your books and grow and learn. We need to all do that and spend the time, as she mentioned, doing that, some of that work ourselves. To move forward. So that's great. Good. Well, good, Kevin, to be back. Season 8, episode 1, under the belt. And we want to thank our sponsors again, to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated, to the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan come together to worship and serve, and to Molly Maid, make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's.
And I'm Kevin George from St. Aidan's Anglican Church.
And remember, my friend, to always look both ways
before you cross the street.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for listening. Our hosts are Kevin George and Rob Henderson. Our producer and composer is myself, Ian, with original artwork done by Elizabeth Dodman. If you have any questions or want to know where to find us, tweet us at Vicar's Crossing or find us on Facebook at The Vicar's Crossing. If you have any other questions about anything heard on this podcast, leave us a comment or look in the description to find out more. Thanks!